on Ways and Means for Tuesday, January 25, 2005, and we continue, colleagues, with our orientation and overview. And today we continue with the overview of the governor's budget. Today we'll be spending the first hour on the education program area and the second hour on the human services program area. So with that in mind, colleagues, obviously there are questions that are going to be coming to mind with these presentations. And as we only have an hour for each one of these topics, I at least urge you to consider some of these as we drive down into some of these questions, that we might be able to be a little bit more effective dealing with that at the subcommittee level. So I don't want to stifle anybody, but just want to make sure that we can stay on agenda. So with that, have felt the representatives from the governor's office in the education overview. Mr. Sager.
Good morning, Co-Chair Doyle, and Co-Chair Schrader, members of the committee. For the record, my name is James Sager from the governor's office, and it's my pleasure to be here this morning to walk you through the opening rounds of our presentation on the governor's budget as it relates to education. We'll go through several slides. I'm going to give you kind of an overview of the governor's thinking as he prepared the budget, and then both Linda Ames and Bill McGee will give you the more technical work on with numbers. So, as you heard yesterday from Teresa McHugh, the governor laid out a series of six principles that he asked all of us to use as we developed this, went through this budget process, that we didn't go through the traditional methodology strictly, even though that was happening simultaneously because of the very strict budget requirements in the system. But we were going through a process where we were measuring all of the expenditures in the budget against the governor's six principles. The one for education we have listed up there, that children's education needs are met and adults have lifelong opportunities to develop career skills through post-secondary education, ongoing training, and professional development. I think it's important that right off the bat, the governor was making it clear to us that education was not individual silos anymore, but in fact, he wanted us to talk about education as a system. The few of the key elements inside the education principle, and that is children ready to learn, and I guess we could describe that really as students ready to learn of all ages as they move through the system. Are we preparing students for the next level of educational opportunity and requirements? That education in thus prepares at each step for the next step for people. That communities are engaged in children's education. If you think back to the early 90s when we first passed House Bill 3565, we really started talking about the fact that education is more than just what takes place in a classroom, whether it's K-12, community college, or university, but it is really what the entire community contributes to support a student and a student's family through the process. That we invest in post-secondary education to promote economic prosperity. The governor has repeatedly stated how education is the driving force, he feels, to our economic future. And this includes, in post-secondary, we include community college certificate programs, two-year degrees, four-year degrees at the university system, and as the last bullet points out, the continuing workforce training that our employees and employers need in order to remain competitive. Thank you. Education as a single enterprise, and if you don't mind, I'd like to take a few minutes to elaborate on that bullet. Probably the first major change that took place in developing this budget was getting all of the education sectors together in a room talking about how we budget, how we spend money to meet the needs of students. So we had repeated meetings with pre-K-12, community college, and university representatives there talking about how their budgets work, how the dollars follow student needs, et cetera. And so just that process was very enlightening to everybody. But what it really did is it opened up the door for communication between the different sectors to talk about not only how successful are we, but where are there holes in the system? How are there better ways to help with these transitions? Are there better ways that we can leverage the dollars, again, that we have in the system to help the other sectors that historically have talked in isolation and have had only at the local level, kind of that level of conversation and not really at the state level? Sustainable funding for pre-K-16 system, and this is especially apparent inside the K-12 area, where during the last 4 years we've had revenues in the first half of the biennium only to have a decrease in the second year of the biennium. And so the governor was very focused on providing stability to school districts so that they could prepare their budgets and know what their baseline was. It's one thing to prepare a budget and then find out later that you received additional money. Much easier to add a program to the system than it is mid-year or midway through a biennium to have to suddenly figure out a way to cut programs. So stability and sustainability was very important. Clearly, we had to make sure that we covered all the mandates that are laid out for education, and that especially comes from the federal level, because when we're dealing with special education needs, we have maintenance of effort requirements that, honestly, we're tracking very closely, because we are constantly right kind of on the edge of maintaining that or meeting that maintenance of effort requirement that the federal government has, and we don't want to find ourselves in a position where suddenly we're being told by the federal government that, in fact, we're in violation of that. Also, next one, yeah, the affordability of post-secondary education. We have moved from a state that was a low-tuition, low-aid state for post-secondary to a state that is high-tuition, low-aid. And what that has done is it has closed the door for thousands of Oregonians to pursue a post-secondary education. And the governor felt that it was absolutely imperative that we bring a halt to that process. The focus for the governor very clearly was on the needs of students. And so that is why he made the added investment into the Oregon Opportunity Grant, where, again, we're going to be able to, for the first time, really help a large number of Oregon students, not only those that are currently receiving opportunity grants, maybe absorb the increased cost in tuition, excuse me, but to open the door to tens of thousands of other Oregon students who currently are not able to maybe work part-time and go to school. One of the interesting statistics that the governor looked at was, while many of us in this room probably went through our post-secondary experience working part-time and going to school, that today's student would have to work 53 hours a week in order to pay for their tuition. Well, you can't expect someone to be carrying a full load of academic program and working 53 hours a week. So the conditions have changed from when many of us went to school, and this was very apparent to the governor, and so he really wanted to focus in on the opportunity grants. And also investment in infrastructure. It has been over 20 years since we invested in community colleges, for instance. They have many needs. In our OUS system, we have some fine examples of situations that we must take care of. If any of you have been to the Oregon State campus, you know that you may not know that the heating plant there, if Corvallis drops to below 27 degrees, we have to shut down the university. It cannot pump out the heat necessary to heat that campus. The old boilers that are in the facility, five of them were in there, only three of them are running. We went and visited the workers there who are literally masters at keeping these old boilers operating as best they can, but we're in desperate need of upgrading that system. And there are examples like that all throughout the system. So the governor, again, looked at this from the standpoint of how can we combine meeting our infrastructure needs at the community colleges and the university system and simultaneously help the economy in all of these communities by working on the infrastructure, putting Oregonians to work on those projects, and again helping to stimulate the economy. And then the seamless transition through the system. Like I said, this is our conversations have led to a number of projects that the education community now is working on together, whether it's early entrance into post-secondary experiences, aligning the curriculum in a much better way, talking about really how we can have the exit point of different steps along the way match up with the entrance point, so a student leaving high school, for instance, can actually know that their skill level matches up to the entrance level in post-secondary, those kinds of discussions. And so the education community is working much more closely as a coordinated system. The governor also laid out a series of efficiencies, and I want to make it clear that we did not include in the budget the savings from these efficiencies as part of the calculation, because we realize that many of these ideas are efficiencies that can be developed during the biennium, but in fact the savings will not be seen until future years. But they're the right things to do. Our school districts, because of budget constraints, for instance, in K-12, and our community colleges and universities, for that matter, have done a lot of work internally, inside their district, inside their university, to look at efficiencies. But it's now time to look at system-wide efficiencies, again, to help break down those barriers. So some of the recommendations that the governor has put forward that we're talking with education leaders about are consolidating ESDs. Currently have 20. We believe that number can be consolidated, but that also we can look at inside the K-12 system consolidating central office business functions. We have good examples like the Scappoose School District, where a couple years ago they went to the Northwest Regional ESD and asked if they could run the payroll system.
Senator Carter's question.
I'm sorry.
Jim, just want to go back. Just want you to elaborate a little bit on the central campus idea. But the other one is, did I hear you say that the efficiencies that you had gotten from the budgets of these institutions were not put into the report as savings, but rather you saved them for future use? Is that what I heard you say?
Co-Chair Schrader and Senator Carter, what I was trying to point out was that we didn't... The savings that we believe will come from the efficiencies that we're calling for, we're not turning around and saying, well, that means schools or campuses are really receiving an additional amount of money. What we're doing is talking about the kinds of system efficiencies that do two things. Number one, they are future savings as far as dollars, but also we want to make sure that those dollars are then freed up to provide direct service to students. So we're not saying that we're reducing the cost of education. We're freeing up dollars to help direct services to students.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, the reason I asked that question, because I think a distinction should be made, Jim, between those institutions who do work well to the goals of their efficiencies but are not sanctioned by you taking the money by the state, taking those dollars from them that they have saved, but find some kind of way that people who do operate efficiently are not sanctioned by taking dollars away from their savings if there is a goal for future use. And how do you guys do that? What's your strategy for doing that? Because all schools are not doing that bad where they're using their money in somebody else's money. But some schools are, you know, taking those efficiencies and using them to the greater good of programs within the institutions.
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Carter, we agree totally that, again, those districts that maybe take the lead or do the most when it comes to efficiency should not be penalized for those efficiencies. And so we agree totally with you. That's why we're working very carefully with, in the case of the consolidation idea, with ESD superintendents and local superintendents to make sure that, again, the dollars are freed up inside the district so they can use them to the benefit of their students as opposed to it being a system-wide reduction of costs.
Do we quantify that, James? I'd like to, you know, all these efficiencies are fascinating, but I guess I'd like to quantify those in terms of dollars and what that means that school districts could, you know, improve their programs with.
Coach Schrader, in fact, that's what we're working on right now. We hope that within the next couple weeks we will have information back from the ESDs and the districts, for instance, as to the types of programs that they would be able to implement in order to put a number to what that savings would be. The example, I don't think I finished my example of SCAPOOS. The SCAPOOS example, just with payroll, is they're able to save, SCAPOOS School District saves $30,000 a year by having the Northwest Regional ESD run their payroll. That is a half a teacher. So the school district is able to put that money back into student programs. We have four school districts in Monroe County where the Monroe County ESD superintendent went to the districts. They laid out the kinds of programs that they could absorb, and the ESD was able to do it for half the cost. So the school district saved half of their cost on those items. So those are the kinds of efficiencies that we would like to stimulate to be statewide, and we hope to quantify with some fairly accurate numbers for you very shortly.
Representative Krupp.
Representative Smith was ahead of me, sorry.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. A few moments earlier, you were talking about capital construction projects, and that's part of the package. A lot of elected officials around the state are talking about the ODOT projects and how those help put people back to work. But in reality, those bonds weren't let during the time when those projects were supposedly going on. The question I have is when are these projects scheduled to occur, when will the bonds be let, and when can we expect a shovel to hit the ground?
Co-Chair and Representative Smith, the timeline, as I understand it, and Bill can probably go in, and Linda can go into more detail on this in a few minutes, is that we want to make sure that the projects are well-defined and laid out. So there are different kinds of projects, for instance. Some of them will be coming online fairly quickly, within the, say, the first year of the biennium. Others will be coming on board towards the second and then into the next biennium. And the difference really has to do with, are we looking at deferred maintenance programs like the OSU boiler situation, where they know very clearly what they need to do and can move quickly on that. Some of the campus projects, like the community colleges are looking at, take a lot more time and are going to require a community support for matching funds, et cetera. So it's really a series of projects that will take place over, what would the startup time would probably be about a 3-year period of time for most of these.
Just a quick comment.
We'll need some shorter answers, James.
I'm sorry.
We're going to get through this in the human services budget.
Can you just provide each of us with a listing of those projects and the timelines? We're being charged to prioritize projects, and I want to see how those are. And I know it's been created, and I just have to see that.
We'll do that.
Thank you.
Representative Krupp, then Senator Bates, and then Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. James, what's the governor's position on small school districts that are relatively close together, sharing resources such as superintendents working half-time between both school districts and those types of efficiencies?
Co-Chair and Representative Krupp, again, I think what we need to look at are the outcomes that we expect for children. And if the school districts are able to put together those kinds of efficiencies and provide the services that children need, we support those kinds of efforts.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So I'll move on now so we can get into the
debates real quick.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, Senator Johnson.
James, I'm glad you used the SCAPOOS example, but my question is a little more global. If SCAPOOS can save $30,000 having the ESD do their back room, there are five other school districts in Columbia County, not that great a distance. Who's taking a global look to say if SCAPOOS saves $30,000, why can't St. Helens? Why can't Vernonia? Why can't Rainier? And where in the budget comes the incentivizing to say to these guys, either the ESDs, you all need to go do this, or the school districts, if there's a $30,000 savings, you need to go find it? I'm not sure that we should be celebrating a one-off $30,000 savings if we're leaving four other $30,000 savings on the table.
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Johnson, we agree, the governor agrees. What we couldn't come up with was a way to put aside a sum of money that we could use to incentivize, as you suggest, this effort. What has been interesting in the dialogue with the people involved is that the incentive is there because everybody recognizes the tight budget constraints we're in. And so people are very committed to looking at these efficiencies and putting together a program, and we hope to have those details to you quite soon.
Thank you. And I'm sure the governor is more than open to any other alternatives that Richard and his committee will come up with.
Absolutely.
In that regard.
So let me turn it over to Ms. Linda and Bill, and then go into some budget detail numbers.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Linda Ames with Budget and Management, and I primarily do the K-12 budget. This last slide shows our splits by principal rather than the more traditional program area. So you can see on the general fund part, by principal, education and workforce is about 58% of our general fund lottery budget, which is similar to the program area with some small change differences on the margins, really.
Oh, there's some significant changes there, Linda, but that's okay. Go ahead.
The percentage is similar, but...
No, that's inaccurate. Go ahead.
The next section gives a little bit more detail in each of the education sectors to help understand funding levels and context for the governor's budget. This is the state school fund over the last several years. I've actually split it out year by year, but the last 2 years here, 05, 06, 06, 07, is the $5 billion state budget and a $2.5 billion local funds, mostly property tax revenue. I specifically laid it out year by year to show the instability that we've had as we've had cuts on the state piece. I also wanted to point out that while state funding is growing slowly, local funding does just keep chugging along, and that has definitely helped the schools. Next biennium, compared to the current biennium, there'll be an increase in about $84 million in state funding, but over $200 million in local revenues.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Linda, why isn't federal funding factored into this graph?
I think only because the federal funding flows through the department's budget rather than being specifically in the state school fund. It is not distributed on the state school fund formula, but there is indeed another roughly $1 billion in federal funding next biennium. And it's distributed on different formulas. But
I think that one of the things that's interesting to the people in this process is to look at the totality of funding that's going into the schools. And I don't know if you've got something like that in your presentation, but if you don't, I think it would be very instructive for the members of this committee to be able to see over time all of the funding sources that come in. I know it gets a little tricky when you get down to some of the local special funds that are in place, but to get the federal funds and the property tax funds and the state school funds and then the money that flows through the Department of Ed budget in the form of grants that actually has a general fund genesis to it, I think would be an interesting thing for people to see.
We can sure get that. Representative Richardson.
Quick question, Mr. Chair. What would be the number of increase in federal funds? You said that there were 200 additional in local funding, so the governor's at 5.0, so now we're actually at 5.2 because there's $200 million in additional local property tax funding. How much additional federal funds?
Representative, that's not accurate. I think that's a point that needs to be made.
Yeah.
Governor's pointed out that we get some local revenues coming in, property tax revenues that make up the total school allocation. I think it needs to be pointed out to the committee that while it's up a little bit from last session, it's not up any over what it usually is historically. You just look at the graph here, as Ames pointed out, and that the local portion has gone up steadily. It goes up 5-6% biennium. I mean, that's just the way of it. So this is not actually any new money. It does not augment exceptionally the state school fund. This one biennium, it's a little bit more than what we had the biennium before. So I think it's important for members to put this in the historical context.
I thought you said that the local funding went up by $200 million. I may have misunderstood that. Is that what you said, or is that not correct?
We're talking about local funding, though. It's not part of the state school fund. And that always goes up, except for, I think, a couple rare cases in the last 10 years.
But it does get used for schools.
Yeah. Yeah. So your question?
My question is, how much did federal funding go up that isn't included in this discussion so far?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, my recollection is it's about $150 million over the biennium, increase in federal funds.
Thank you very much.
For a total of about $1 billion.
Thanks. Representative Smith, and then we'll hit the Senate side.
Thank you, Co-Chair. I need a little 101 here, and I think that's what today's about. On the local revenue, and I guess I open this up to committee members and yourself, on the local revenue, I assume that that's property tax, then that goes directly to the local school district. Can you help me with that? And here's my question. Where I'm trying to get with
question.
This. What happens to our communities who rely on local revenue who don't have an economic base equivalent to those other communities who do?
Don't get Richard all wound up now. Linda, would you like to do it more impartial?
And I'm just trying to get a 101 here.
Linda will give you a more impartial answer to that.
Okay. The local revenue is mostly property tax. There are some other smaller pieces like common school fund. It does go to the local schools, but it is equalized through the state formula. So the dollars, both local and state, per student are roughly equal to all districts.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Okay, Senator Devlin, if you behave yourself.
I think the bottom line to understand in this budget process in terms of education is that the governor's budget is, depending upon how you look at it, either about $315 million below essential level or maybe about $420 million below essential level, depending upon how well you believe school districts will do in terms of controlling their health care costs. If they do better than we do, they will only be about $316 million short. If they do as we will probably do, they will probably be more like $400 million short. The issue of local school funding, and I'll just be very quick here, Mr. Chairman, is simply an equalization issue. There are some school districts in this state where 20% comes from their local revenue. There are some actually where 60 and 70% comes from their local revenue. It is all equalized. The other issue to keep in mind in terms of federal funding is while some of it will benefit large groups of students, most of it is dedicated towards very specific purposes and will not have an impact on the funding available to the majority of students.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let's see if we have Senator Bates, Senator Carter, and Senator Nelson.
I think the questions that were brought up have been pretty well answered by the members. Representative Morgan and I went through this for 6 months, 2 years ago, and I think we understand it pretty well. The explanation has been good. The one thing that we probably do need to focus on a little bit, though, is that in the middle of the last biennium, after we left session, local revenues did increase more than we expected. That was a real thing. And we equalized that, of course, to the state school fund. And that helped a little bit for the districts coming into this session. Whether that increase will be more than expected again is the question I think we really have to ask ourselves, and we don't know the answer to that. We've had a lot of new construction in the state. We've had a lot of refinancing the state, which brings things in a different perspective as far as rebuilds are concerned, what that does for local revenue. So it's kind of an unknown piece. But balanced against that is some other costs that we don't know also. FERS, health care are the two biggest ones I'm concerned about. So I'm not sure quite where we stand in total funds for schools right now. I don't think we could know absolutely for another probably 3 or 4 weeks. That's the sense I'm getting on revenue. Is that something that you would agree with?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we did update our local property tax forecast based on those higher collections that we saw this year, but it is still a forecast, and we will update it again. Legislative revenue will take the lead in doing that again this spring. As far as what was the other question?
I didn't ask a question. I tried to answer some things that were floating around the room. I think everyone pretty well covered it.
Why don't we move this?
The PERS.
Mr. Chairman, I'm asking all of you before I make my statement to forgive me, and I mean no disrespect. With that being said, do I see head shaking?
Uh-oh.
And I say that simply because in 1991, the voters of this state said, legislature, we want you to be the statewide school system, the school statewide school board of directors, which put the responsibility on the state to fund schools. Local dollars augment what local communities want to see enhanced in their communities. And those dollars should not be the dollars that we as the state use to abdicate our responsibility as the state's statewide school board. That is not what this is all about. And I know if you take in consideration Multnomah County, all of us have decided we want to pay a little extra money because we have about 372 different derivatives of language spoken in our district, and most of you don't even have 10 different derivatives of that going on. And so to sit up for us as a state and not do our jobs as a statewide school board and fund schools at the level in which we are obligated constitutionally to fund it does not give us the right to sit up and want to know what locals do. I don't want to know what locals do. I want to know what we as a state are supposed to be doing for education. And with that being said, I hope that we are not looking and feeling excited about we've given 5.2, and so we're taking consideration those little dollars that you get at the local level and add that to schools, and that's how much we're doing school. No, you're not. You're not doing that. And somewhere along the line, we need to get that in our heads as a committee that has the responsibility after 1991, ballot measure 5, to be the kind of school board we're supposed to be, and that is to look at what we're supposed to be doing as a state. My apologies if I offended anyone.
Anything else you care to follow?
Yes, sir. I want to follow that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just thought maybe I found $700 million on page 8.
$700 million of local dollars.
Yesterday we were talking about 11.9 or something like that. What figure are we working with? I'm sort of having a little confusion here. $700 million. I mean, what the heck?
Mr. Chair, Senator, on the footnote, these numbers by principle don't include judicial and legislative branches, unfortunately.
But that's the funds. I mean, we're talking about the total funds. Yesterday we're talking general fund and lottery funds is 11.9. Today we're talking about 11.2.
And this graph is actually the expenditure side, and because those branches did not participate in the principal
budget. Well, I didn't understand. Thank you very much.
We had the same question in panic just before the presentation started yesterday.
Very alert group here. Got to be careful. All right.
This shows, if you adjust for inflation, since we passed Measure 5, that the per-student funding is slightly lower. These are not perfect measures, but it does give you some sense. And you see we hit a low point in 96-97 as we are phasing through.
Sorry to interrupt. Senator Devlin has an urgent question.
I just wanted to point out one thing, and I just want a quick response to this. In the three major budget areas where general funds are dedicated, education, human services, and public safety, there are a few other very limited exceptions to this. But in most of those other budgets, being public safety and human services, the governor chose to fund PERS increases and health care increases. In the education budget, specifically K through 12, he chose not to. Is that a fair characterization? Or he chose to provide, I'm trying to figure out, of the about $400 million in need, what is the $100 million for?
Mr. Chair,
it's fair to characterize that he did not fund health care increases or PERS increases in K through 12.
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, I think it's just kind of the way that you build the two budgets that make it seem that way. I think in DHS, for instance, while we did build budgets including the PERS increase, we also cut programs in that budget, meaning that we cut people, generally speaking. And
well,
in that sense, that is the same thing that education would end up needing.
Mr. Chairman, just to back up, I've heard references to administrative savings in K through 12. Some of them have totaled $30,000 potential. That hardly equals $316 million or $400 million. To believe somehow that education is going to come up after cutting for three consecutive bienniums with that level of cuts is probably beyond any reasonable level of belief, and we'll probably debate this for the rest of the session. I think that the governor clearly did not fund those things in K-12 and chose not to.
And that's as kind as my statement will be today. So.
That's very good.
That's what the governor's office has, at least get through their initial presentation. We all have different opinions on it.
Please, Trader, do you want me to comment or wait?
No, that's fine. Go right ahead.
I'm just giving you a preview.
I have a feeling, Mr. Co-Chair, that we'll have plenty of opportunity in Senator Devlin's subcommittee.
Exactly. We're just setting the stage here.
Okay, Mr. Chair. I did, before we move off of K-12, I did want to lay out some of the major cost drivers. And, of course, this is where we see PERS. And because 80 or 85% of school district budgets are personnel, it's not surprising that the major cost drivers have to do with the increased cost of people. Health benefits, we've assumed at 12% a year. PERS at a 4 percentage point increase, and based on today's stories, possibly quite a bit more. COLAs and steps that are still modest by historical standards, because we are still seeing the savings from a lot of retirements and bringing in lower paid teachers, but we're seeing that tail off now compared to the last couple of years. The fourth point I did want to note is, while the basic population figures for school age kids is not growing rapidly, and yesterday I think we saw the chart where that population was growing 3.6% over the 10-year period, what is growing is the cost of the changing student demographics, in particular English as a second language, special education. English as a second language, just in terms of numbers of kids, has increased by 4 times since 1992 compared to what we built into the governor's budget. And these are really what's driving the increases in costs on the student side. With that, we should probably go ahead and move on.
Mr. Chair, Bill McGee, Department of Administrative Services. I work on the post-secondary education budgets, so if we could continue with the presentation. The next slide is the projected enrollment for the Department of Higher Education, the university system campuses from 1995-96 through 2013-14. Again, I included this just to show you that there is a continuing demand for higher education in the state. The very sharp growth of the early part of this decade has slowed somewhat, but with the baby boom echo continuing, we are expecting to see continued demand in the sector. The next slide is intended to give you just some of the details on what is in the governor's budget for Oregon University System. I think you've heard we have $102.3 million for 10 deferred maintenance projects at the various campuses, including the OSU heating plant that Mr. Sager mentioned a minute ago. And we have $253 million in other capital projects at the different campuses. In addition, there's $20 million in certificates of participation for critical information technology and telecommunications infrastructure at the campuses. The largest is the phone system at Oregon State University, which is the backbone for the whole system. The governor has $1 million for faculty compensation. Our faculty are significantly underpaid. Our review of national data indicates that depending on the campus and the rank of the professor, we're looking at salary levels that are anywhere from 3 to about 25% below peer institutions nationally. This clearly does not address that problem in a major way, but it does continue to raise the issue as one that is very important for our campuses as well.
Sure. Question, Representative Grubb.
Thank you. Could you provide us with an analysis of the average hours that professors are actually in the classroom teaching at higher ed? Some years ago, I believe, before I was in the legislature, there was a study done of that, and it was a bit disappointing in the actual hours that well-placed and well-regarded and respected professors were actually in the classroom teaching as opposed to their teaching assistants. And so if we're talking about an increase to bring them up to a level that's more commensurate with what is occurring nationally, then I would hope that we could compare the hours they are actually in the classroom teaching with that nationally and make sure that, in fact, our students are getting the benefit of their expertise.
Mr. Representative Krupp, we'll contact the system and see what the most current data they have on that issue.
Thank you very much.
The next issue is the budget includes a phase-out of the fee remission cap over two biennia. The programmatic fee remission cap would be increased to 10% of tuition this biennium. The graduate student fee remission cap would be eliminated immediately. The budget accommodates tuition increases of 5 to 7% in the first year of the biennium and 5% in the second year of the biennium. And there is no general fund increase for enrollment. Unlike K-12, there is not a constitutional mandate for students to attend or the state to provide education to every student, so enrollment growth is a policy package that the governor and the legislature need to consider each biennium, and within the constraints of the budget, we don't have funding for that. The next graph, I realize is busy, but it's an attempt to give you a little bit of an indication of what the community college funding model looks like. There are three provisions of that. Each of these sections of the chart starts with the 1999-01 biennium and takes you up to the governor's budget. The leftmost, the darker of the, I guess, the red graph on each of these shows you the decline in general fund resources over this period. The blue amount shows you the increase in local property taxes, and the yellow shows you the significant increase in tuition charges over the biennium as well. As Ms. McHugh indicated yesterday, we do have an error in the governor's budget that he believed that we had a higher level of funding for community colleges than, in fact, we have, and it is our intention to work with you during the session to attempt to address that as well. At the level of funding, without increases, we would expect to see the enrollment decline, which you can tell by the line bar that's going across this, to continue, and tuition increases to also likely to continue as well. Specifically, the budget includes $388.4 million general fund for the community college support. That, again, is a 5.5% reduction, as you've seen in the governor's budget. That is something we need to work with you with.
Going back to your previous graph, I'm sorry. Would it be possible to get that graph and the general fund bar augmented by debt service for community college and also, for, which is negligible or zero now, but also for the higher ed? Have the same type of graph for the higher ed four-year institutions. I don't mean to say higher, four-year institutions.
We can add that. There is a debt service cost about a little over $2 million in community colleges that were continually paid from the bonds that were sold in the 70s and 80s, 70s, I guess.
Mr. Chair?
Question, Senator Bates.
A couple questions real quick, if I could.
Sure.
Could you also include that information that would show us what new bonding would do to the debt service, the six projects we're looking at and the potential projects in the future that need to be done? And also including that any consideration for the potential for taking care of buildings that are deteriorating through debt service. The other question related to this graph, if I could, Mr. Chair, it's a real question of why are enrollments declining for community college. I hear on one hand that it's without offering the section students need, and the other hand I hear tuition's too high and they can't afford to go in. Those things don't match for me. If you have students lined up to take certain sections, it's a supply and demand market. If you got people lined up willing to take it, why aren't you offering those sections? Is it a matter of not having the educators you need? Is it a matter of students are willing to pay the tuition but the sections aren't offered? I'm also concerned about sections that are not heavily used still being offered. This can't seem to get a good handle on that from what I've been hearing from various sources.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, we'll discuss that in the subcommittee, but I think it's a combination of the two. There are some students who can't afford the tuition levels as they do come up. Other students who could afford, perhaps, because of the tuition doesn't necessarily cover the full cost of the courses, the campuses have been forced to reduce their sections or reduce courses and not hire faculty, and so they're unable to offer the courses or as many sections in a course as demand might occur. So I think for different mixes of students, it's a combination of two factors, and I know they'll spend some time on that when they get to subcommittee.
Thank you. Follow, Mr. Chair?
Yep.
It still doesn't make sense to me. I'm sorry. I'm not going to buy it. I know of students trying to get courses. They're willing to pay the price, and the sections are offered once a year or offered every other year or offered twice a year, and they can't get them. And so we're looking at a situation where we have demand, but we can't seem to meet the demand, and then we see graphs saying our enrollment's going down. I just can't buy it. I'm sorry. That goes for OUS, too. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, I have a follow-up for Bill on what Senator Bates has mentioned, and that is we do have this problem of people that want to take classes. They can't graduate in 4 years because they can't fit the classes into the schedule when they're being offered. And so I'm wondering if there's been any discussion with the governor about changing the format and the way things are done. In other words, we still have an idea that if you want more classes, you have to build more facilities, you have to have more teachers and so forth, and yet we have real-time audio-visual where we could have a class being offered at PSU by an excellent instructor that isn't offered at that time frame in SOU that could be attended by direct audio-visual and be able to save a tremendous amount of money and expand the availability of classes to students in every campus of higher learning.
Mr. Chair and Representative Richardson, let me address that a little bit. That is one of the outcomes that these conversations have really led us to. Just last week, Board Director Schutte's committee on access and affordability, which has really been drilling down on these issues, had a wonderful presentation from the campuses, both Community College and OUS, where they are now aligning their courses so that a student could look and say, I can't get this class at Oregon State, but I could go to Chemeketa this summer and pick up the class I need, and it would transfer. And so we are really looking at that merger of the system. So, again, the student benefits by being able to take classes at multiple sites and move through the program much faster. So, again, we should fairly soon have a presentation that we can prepare for you to go over that kind of process.
Okay, just a quick follow-up. You're talking about attending different campuses, which I think is a tremendous step in the right direction. There should be this coordination so that you can get benefit. And I'm wondering if we can use the technological availability that we have now to bring the education to the student instead of forcing the student to go to the education.
I'm sorry, Representative Richardson. Yes, I should have included that. In fact, we're looking at the distance learning network and how we can utilize that better for the students.
Great. Thank you.
And that's a very good point. I think that is the future of a lot of the tough situations for some of our small colleges and some of our remote areas. It's a very, very good point.
I just might mention that they're doing that with American colleges in China so that Chinese students can attend in China a university in America, and it seems like we ought to be able to do that across the state.
Representative Krupp, then Representative Hanna, then Senator Carter, Wardley, and Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, could you... going back to slide number 15, could you provide for, at perhaps a later date, could you provide for the committee the cost drivers and this, that are driving the expenses of community colleges up higher? And that will help me understand perhaps why, if we have declining population and our costs are increasing, why that is. Because it begs to me that there's a train wreck that's going to occur here very, very quickly. And I need to understand what those cost drivers are. Thank you.
Good. We have Representative Hanna, Senator Gordley, Senator Devlin, and
then...
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Sager, the $22 million, or just short of $23 million, that the community colleges are shorted... as it has been reported, is the governor's plan the only way to restore that funding would be on new forecast numbers, or is there any other plan to correct that error?
Chair Schrader and Representative Hanna, we're looking at a variety of ways to approach that, and again, that's why we want to work with the legislature and the community college folks to address that issue. What exactly the number and the target and what we can attain is all part of the discussion, but it's not simply based on future projections. We're wondering if there are ways we might be able to do it inside the current. So those are the conversations we want to have.
Actually, Representative, that's why you got elected. Your job is to help make this happen.
Fix community college funding.
The governor's given us an opportunity to look at that, and that committee under the excellent Chair Richard Devlin will, I'm sure, come up with some outstanding solutions for this body to consider.
Mr. Chair, could I address that question as well? In terms of the magnitude, if you look at the second bullet on the slide in front of you, the governor's budget, when you include the publicly provided resources, the state general fund, and the property tax, is 99%. basically 99% of the 2003-05 level. To, in fact, to bring the campuses back to what the current level of funding is from both those sources would take about $3.9 million. The governor believed we at least had that much in there, if not more, and his intent to help work with that. So we believe the hole to get to current level funding is $3.9 million. Discussions of what's possible beyond that will continue.
Senator Bartley.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. This is for Representative Richardson and, in fact, for all of the members. Representative Richardson referenced distance learning and opportunities that could be captured through distance learning. And I would just suggest that you review the history of what we called the Frontier Learning Network, which was a model linking urban and rural communities. We built this network over at least three legislative sessions. The Frontier Learning Network is not included in this governor's budget. We are, in fact, dismantling the distance learning model that has been built. Just an FYI.
Good comment. Sir Devlin.
I think those 15 minutes, Mr. Sager, or maybe some of the FAM representatives.
I just thought it'd be important for the committee to get some history. Maybe if you could provide us a graph with the level of funding since 97 forward for community colleges. Knowing that the golden age of community college funding lasted from about July 2001 till about December 2001.
It was very short, in other words.
I just wanted to say that in 90, provide that to them. In 97 and 99, we literally did not provide them any increase for enrollment growth. And to be honest, we didn't provide them any increase for much of anything. And we finally recognized that need in the 01 session, and then that disappeared in about 3 or 4 months with the first and second special sessions. I have heard all kinds of numbers about what this shortfall is. I've never heard a number as low as $4 million, to be honest. I've heard from community colleges that they were being told that the shortfall is $8 million. They believe the shortfall is more like $16 to $18 million, and they believe they need about $25 to $30 million to be able to be at what they would consider an essential level. And if you want to comment, too, I think it's important to understand with community colleges, we always try to consider things at a macro level. Because of the way that community colleges are funded, this funding level might have different impacts on different community college districts. Because just because there has been an overall potential, maybe slightly higher than anticipated increase in property taxes, that has a disparate or a different impact on different districts, because community colleges, I'm not advocating that, are not an equalized formula.
Mr. Chair, Representative Senator Devlin, just a clarification. The $3.9 million would be the amount we believe would take the total resource, public resources back to the 0305 level, would not constitute what would be considered a central budget level under the traditional formula for that. That would take additional funding as well.
Representative Morgan had a follow-up on it.
Senator Devlin, I would wonder if you would consider amending your information request to include not only the general fund contribution, but also the local property tax contribution to funding, and then to kind of have in the background the enrollment numbers so that there can be some kind of contextual reference there to the funding levels and to the number of students that are being served.
I would be more than willing to amend my request in that way. And I think it's also important, though, to realize...
That wasn't an opening for more...
Yes, it was an opening. I don't think that you can underestimate the impact of the drop in funding in 01 and the impact it had on tuition and the resultant impact that had on enrollment.
I would just remind everybody that we do have an education subcommittee that will probably be discussing some of this information in detail. I think it is helpful to get some of the questions out now. so that the agency can be prepared, because some of you don't serve on that subcommittee, so it's important for you to have that opportunity to raise these questions. If we can just raise the questions, keep the discussion to a minimum, we've got about 3 minutes to get through the rest of the presentation.
Mr. Chair, I can talk that fast, actually. The last two bullets on this slide, we do have $91.2 million in Article 11 G bonds for six community college projects. At this point, my guess would be the debt service on that, once it finally phases in, which probably is in about 3 years, would be about probably $20 million general fund a biennium. But that's a guess based on what the rates and timing will be. The next slide, the last, very quickly, the highlights on the last two pieces of the post-secondary education budget. As you know, the governor's recommending more than doubling the Oregon Opportunity Grant to $91.6 million. The Oregon Health Science University, $50.2 million general fund for operations, which is reduced from about $86 million in the current biennium. Separate $2.7 million appropriation for the Poison Center to continue that. And the state would continue to pay debt service on the opportunity bonds from tobacco settlement funds for $32 million in the biennium.
Okay.
Senator Carter.
I just want to ask Bill, when you look at major cost drivers, I do think that energy should have been a part of the major cost drivers, because all of our institutions are dealing with very high rising costs of maintaining energy. And so that should be a major cost driver, because they cannot control that. And one other thing is that I think that you should tell the Subcommittee on Education that we do not, I don't think that people know, we do not pay community colleges based on per FTE count either.
That's correct.
And so they're working at a disadvantage in the first place. The third thing you should tell them that is that the governor himself talked about the workforce, that community colleges are the major institutions for preparing workforce in this state. And if we're going to put more people to work, then we should look very seriously at the kind of programmatic activity that is both short-term and long-term that goes in our community colleges. And so if we're going to be for real, quote-unquote, about trying to put more people back to work in this state, then now is a critical time to not be cutting community colleges.
I do have a question. Thank you, Co-Chair Schrader. Representative Morgan today and actually Co-Chair Schrader last week, you raised an issue about information and being able to look at it in its totality. One of the frustrations I'm having right now is I'm trying to figure out, based on the information you're providing us, where does other pieces of the funding mix come in terms of intergovernmental agreements and contracts and relationships, community contributions, rental proceeds, grants, foundations, fundraisers? And I, perhaps now's not the time to answer that, but if I could have an answer to that, and I'd like it not only at the college and or university and community college level, but all the way through the whole system, how those additional sources of funding play out in the school districts, in Head Start, all the way up the line.
Senator Morissette.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to focus more specifically on the nurse shortage in the state of Oregon. That was touched on in the broad sense by both Senator Bates and Senator Carter. I've talked with our own president, Mary Schulte, at Plain Community College, and I get that same double answer that Senator Bates was talking about, and I don't buy it either. I'd like to know the cost of the nursing program, if you can assess the cost of the nursing program in the various institutions and the waiting list in the various institutions to get into the nursing program. And if you can figure out what the shortage in Oregon is, that would be wonderful. I don't know if you can do that, but I think we have a huge shortage. We have people who want to become nurses. The pay is a living wage. Hospitals depend on them. People don't want to work in hospitals because of the stress and the overtime. So nurses are getting out of hospitals now, looking for jobs in doctor's offices and other things. And we do have a crisis. And we need to solve it. So any information on that would be appreciated.
And what we'll do is we'll probably have BAM work closely with LFO to queue up these requests so that we're not overwhelming you, but trying to do it real thoughtful, maximum advantage for the subcommittee and members.
We have, yes, Senator Winters, I'm sorry, and then Senator Gorbachev.
Mr. Chair, even though a lot of this will be vetted at the subcommittee level, I think the discussion here today has been very, very helpful given two things. One, we have a lot of new members, and so the retrospective discussion that we're having and the input from others who have been here in previous discussions, I think, is extremely extremely helpful. And then not all of us will be serving on the subcommittee on ed, and that dialogue has been helpful. And I think that contribution, I think, will go well with all of us on. I had to say that because we won't be there to vet this information, and yet I know that there's an extreme interest by all the members of this panel of education and where and why and what these investments may or may not need. I want to piggyback on both Senator Marsette and Bates. It's extremely, to me, to find out what is happening in the nursing, in the field of nursing, not only the field of nursing, but medical as well. We have a severe crisis in this state. We talk about the need for investment in workforce. We talk about the need in creating good paying jobs, and yet I too don't see the activity or the budget that is directed to that, whether we're talking about in the nursing field or the allied health fields, or even talking about biomeds and some of those. So I think I would like to know what really are we planning in those arenas in our community colleges and also in our university systems.
Very good. Proceed.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Gordley.
No, that's quite all right.
I apologize.
One of the things that strikes me about the conversation we're having this morning is it's the loss of equity of opportunity that will exist in all of our systems of education, the continuum of education. If we look at K-12, the budget level proposed by the governor diminishes opportunities to continue to make achievement gains for those students who've historically, traditionally been underserved, the low-income white students, the students of color. The loss of equity of opportunity connected to that, access to community colleges, and then connected to that, the loss of equity of opportunity and access to our system of higher ed. What concerns me is that I don't hear us talking about that loss, and that what we are going to be left with if we continue on this path is a system of education, particularly community colleges and at the higher ed level, that is tiered, and it is available for those who have money. And people who do not will be left out. And so it becomes a class system for elites. And I'm deeply troubled by that, and I'm deeply troubled that more of that the equity issue isn't more pronounced in and evident in our discussion, even in the presentation of the governor's principles around education. And I have not read his most recent report in response to why we're not adequately funding education. But we have to keep this principle of equity in front of us, Mr. Co-Chair. Mm-hmm. And I would like to see more of us thinking about it, talking about it, and internalizing it as a value.
Very good.
Mr. Chair, this would be an excellent place for us to stop. The last few slides are really context. It gives you a chance to look at what the education program looks like compared to the state, and those are things you could review on your own, and certainly we can have more discussion at this meeting.
You're an excellent presenter, Linda. Thank you very much. You did a good job, and I appreciate your comments, all our questions. It's an interest for all of us, obviously.
Mr. Chair, before Jim, tagging on to Representative Morgan and Senator Devlin's question, could you also present that information, which I assume you will do on a statewide collective 17 campuses basis, could you also break that down per individual campus? Because it's been noted here this morning, there's an inequity in the funding in terms of, it's kind of the flip side of the K-12 model, where many community colleges' property taxes are going into a pool to subsidize other community colleges. So could you break that down on a statewide or on an individual institutional basis?
Yes. Thank you very much. Human Services, come on down.
Can I be excused, Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Let's see, who can't speak here? To keep it up, it'd be Bates, Westland, Winners, maybe Dennis. I don't know Dennis Richardson yet. We'll see.
Can we get a schmooze break here, Mr. Chair?
No schmooze break. We're moving on.
Questions at hand.
Schmooze yourself in the halter.
No, snooze.
Snooze break. No, sir. Please proceed.
Good morning, Co-Chair Schrader, members of the committee. My name is Erin Kelly Seal, and I am the governor's advisor on issues relating to health and human services. Pleasure to be here today. We're just going to launch right in.
I'm sorry, we have a question. Just a moment.
Not a question, Mr. Chairman.
No, not a question.
No, we're going to be welcoming a baby in the Capitol.
Oh.
A new baby from Erin in May.
That's appropriate. She's presenting this particular
topic. That's
right. The budget baby. Thank you, Senator Carter.
Budget baby. Yeah. Well, now, wait a second. Let's hope we're out of here before that baby is born.
Well, that would be fantastic from my perspective.
Could you deliver prematurely for us?
Not too prematurely, but a little early is never a bad thing. I'm going to just give a really high-level perspective, and I think one of the biggest challenges for me this morning is probably not to go into too much depth. I have a limited amount of time, and you'll probably hear from us a lot of deferral, but we'll go into as much as we can. You all are familiar now with the six principles that guided the decisions in the governor's budget, and I think particularly in discussing this area, the governor's quite, very frank acknowledgement that difficult decisions had to be made in terms of his pursuit of a vision of long-term sustainability and the short-term decisions that he had to make in this budget. One of the things I just want to highlight within this particular area as we talk about human services is that, in fact, the human service agencies, as we typically think of them, actually the services they provide further really three of the governor's principles. I just want to highlight and make sure folks are attentive to that. First, education and workforce development. For example, the Commission on Children and Families plays an integral role in readiness to learn, which is included along with the Oregon Pre-K in education, et cetera. Also, our TANF, our vocational rehab programs, the Commission for the Blind, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, Self-Sufficiency, the Voc Rehab, those all play a role in workforce development. And so the education workforce development principle should not be lost as you think about your human service agencies' budgets. Public safety is a second principle that I think the human services that are provided in Oregon actually support and have a critical role in DHS child welfare, child and adult protective services by keeping people safe, the Oregon State Hospital, the Psychiatric Security Review Board, Long-Term Care Ombudsman. Each of those entities plays a role in keeping people free from harm, which is part of the public safety principle that the governor has articulated. Today we're focused, though, I know, on the health and basic needs principle, and each of the services provided by the agencies at least indirectly supports the health and basic need principle that the governor has articulated. And so that's what we're going to be talking most about today. I think I just want to stress in terms of process for me with the governor's budget development, I want to be sure that you all knew that in talking about these agency decisions, the difficult decisions that were made, there was a lot of conversation between myself, Craig Campbell, the public safety advisor, from whom you'll hear tomorrow, as well as James Sager, who you just heard from, because we all recognize the linkages between our program areas and the goals and the vision that the governor's trying to further. So those conversations were a big part of the development and budget decision making that happened in our office. I just decided within each of these areas that an approach to take would be to focus in. It's structured in somewhat of a similar way as the Department of Human Services, the way that the Department of Human Services clusters are organized, but it's really designed just to highlight a few key points that the governor focused on as he was thinking about human services. The first is safety and basic needs for children, seniors, and people with disabilities. And I would say that some guiding principles in focusing on that element were both support for family stability and permanency, as well as helping vulnerable Oregonians with basic food and shelter needs. Just some examples of that: prevention efforts to preserve families and avoid entry into child welfare and the foster care system, I think, fall within that first permanency stability issue. Support for foster and adoptive parents when children are coming out of the child welfare system was critical as well. On the food and shelter needs, nutritional and housing assistance for our most vulnerable folks, low-income folks, and this, again, relates back to some of our self-sufficiency programs that you just can't ignore, recognizing the role that employment plays in helping people to meet their own nutritional and housing needs. In the area of...
Question, Representative Smith.
Just very quickly, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. On the basic food and shelter needs, how often does the Department of Human Services meet with Repine Shop to talk about housing needs?
Different segments of program within the agency, at least it's my understanding, meet very frequently with Bob Repine. I know that Gary Weeks, the director of DHS, regularly meets with Bob Repine. We also have what's called, which you all put into effect through statute, the Interagency Coordinating Council on Hunger, and that includes the directors from multiple agencies, including housing and the Department of Human Services, and conversations about the relationship between self-sufficiency, family stability, housing occur very frequently. I think it's at least bi-monthly that group meets.
Yeah, it's not very often I know the answer to one of my questions, and I appreciate you bringing that point up, so thank you.
In the area of physical health, mental health, and addiction services, this area obviously was one within which there were some very difficult decisions to be made. You'll see, I think, when Pam breaks out the different budget components, that this is one of the largest areas in terms of general fund that the Department of Human Services has within its responsibility. And this incorporates programs such as the Oregon Health Plan, our community level and community-based mental health and addiction services, also public health, which all of us as Oregonians take advantage of. I think in this area what I wanted to stress was just that the governor's focus was on preserving basic care for the most vulnerable. Some of the most challenging decisions I think we faced were with respect to the Oregon Health Plan. We had an interim discussion about the Oregon Health Plan, which some of you participated in, to talk about the future long-term sustainability of that program, recognizing that healthcare costs for the state, much like for employers and for individuals, are increasing at rates 2 to 3 times general fund revenue, and the governor is very concerned that we have an ability to look ahead and say to ourselves, what are we doing with this program, and how can we sustain it over time for as many people as possible? You probably also know that at this point, the general fund only supports that component of the Oregon Health Plan that serves our seniors and people with disabilities, as well as children and pregnant women. And so that was the portion of the budget in terms of long-term sustainability that we were focused on. The challenges here, first, there are some significant statements, I think, in the governor's budget made within the Oregon Health Plan around system efficiencies and management actions. That was the first place that the governor focused and on trying to achieve savings before having to get into program impacts around population and benefits served for those individuals. There are only a few levers that the state has to pull in terms of the Oregon Health Plan. One is system efficiencies, which also include things like reimbursement for providers. A second are benefits that are provided to the individuals served, and a third are the populations that we actually are serving. And in the discussion in the work group, there was definitely a sense that folks wanted to avoid and put as a last result any reduction in benefit or population, which we certainly support. Another incentive for taking that approach is that Oregon currently has in place a series of waivers with the federal government that actually allow us to save money through use of what's called the prioritized list. And so as the governor made decisions about this particular program, one of the things we strove to do, as I say here, is maintain basic care for the most vulnerable. We're basically at that point in terms of the populations we're serving in the what's called the OHP plus, with the OHP plus benefit. And so the decision was made to reduce benefit before population with the idea that we would rather serve more people with less, even though that wasn't a very fun choice to have to make, but keep as many people insured through the health plan as possible rather than reduce the population that we're serving. That was a very difficult decision. But as I said, I think our goal was to maintain the waiver and also to maintain some very critical services. That's not to say that some were lost, but prescription drugs, mental health, and chemical dependency services, I think this group certainly can appreciate, are very critical to that particular group of vulnerable folks. The second bullet just mentions preserving and maximizing community-based infrastructure. You'll also hear from Pam something that is not unique to state government, but I think slightly unique in this particular area that I hope people grow to appreciate, is that much of what the department does, I've heard, I think in terms of general fund, it's about 74%, but in terms of total funds, it's somewhere around 80% or perhaps slightly more, is actually contracted out for others to do. The Department of Human Services in particular is not considered, with the exception of child welfare and our self-sufficiency program, to be the direct service provider for most of the services that actually are provided. Mm-hmm. And so in this case, when I say the governor's focus was on preserving and maximizing that infrastructure piece, that's really particularly relevant to the conversation around mental health and addiction treatment services. Addiction treatment services over the last several years have been very significantly reduced, and there was a decision made not to reduce them any further in the governor's budget. And mental health treatment services have been the subject of a lot of conversation so far in the building, and I know will continue to be. The governor also had an interim task force on mental health, and there was significant discussion in that group about the value of services for mental health that are being provided at the community level, and stressing the need to maintain the services at the community as a first priority. And that's, although they were not certainly held harmless, there was an effort made to minimize any impact so that we could preserve that infrastructure. Mental health services, like public health services, are delivered at the county level, and so that's where those impacts are, I think, are most felt. Public health, likewise, currently... I'm sorry,
Erin. Question center one.
Erin, just a quick question, and going back to the discussion about preserve and maximize community-based infrastructure, and whether or not there was some dialogue inside of the group to follow on with what we had discussed in several sessions, and that is, as we let those contracts and as we work with the counties and what have you, that they're done in such a way that we can get some outcome information. We spend a lot of time on this side of the aisle in trying to determine as to what we're paying for, if that what we're paying for really, that we're getting the results from it. And so I ask if that occurred in the discussion and what the agency plans in the future to try to get us that outcome information that we need in order to do a better job on this side of the aisle.
Thank you, Co-Chair Schrader and Senator Winters. I do want to stress that in terms of the decision-making and these themes, that outcomes were part of the conversation throughout the discussion that was happening around human services, much like I know you all will be focusing on, particularly in this area last session. What you all did, I think the department and all of us, a great service by passing, I believe it was Senate Bill 297, which actually requires some outcome-based, evidence-based best practice investment on the part of the department, particularly focused on mental health and addiction services. And so that bill allows for a phase-in in terms of the department's ability to demonstrate that the program dollars that are being spent on evidence-based outcomes. So the department has already started to do that in terms of phase-in and is moving, and ultimately 75% of those programs will have to be demonstrably evidence-based and best practice. I'm forgetting the term on the spot here that's actually included in the bill, but it is something that the department has supported, and it's been very helpful, I think, in the department's work with its partners to strive toward that end and to get you good information and data.
My concern is even more basic than that, and that is that we have contracts that are out. We purchase beds, for example, for alcohol and drug, and yet we don't know whether or not that treatment modality has been successful. We don't know what the recidivism rates are. We have spent, some of us that have been on human services for several sessions, have wanted to have asked this question repeatedly. Do you have in place within your contracts, and if you can follow those contracts and say, you know, if we're paying for X, what's the result of X? And if that wasn't the discussion, I would hope that you would have that kind of discussion inside of the department, because I think it's critical that we know that what we're paying for through those contracts, that we're getting some kind of results.
Thank you. I think the only last point I wanted to make on community-based infrastructure is around the area of public health. Again, I think that it's often public health is something that all of us as Oregonians, in terms of clean water, their ability to respond to communicable diseases, are dependent upon. And interestingly enough, in Oregon, per capita, per person, we spend about 60 cents in our public health investment, whereas our neighbor to the north, the state of Washington, spends $4 per capita. Looking at that and hearing from our local public health friends who play a very significant role in keeping Oregonians healthy, there was a decision made to really preserve at least that per capita funding that exists. And so what you'll see, I think, as you look more in more detail at the Department of Human Services budget, is that the reductions, quote-unquote, to public health are very small, and that's primarily driven both by what I just discussed and also the fact that the majority of funding that goes toward public health is federal dollars, not general fund dollars. So I just want to highlight that there. One other key point is investment access. There is a strategic investment in the governor's budget in school-based health centers. This is something that the governor has strongly supported, feels very very passionate about, the ability of children in particular to access community-based care, not necessarily that all children be insured, although that would certainly be a goal to strive for. But there is an investment in the governor's budget in expanding our current school-based health center capacity. Currently, 14 counties have school-based health centers, and this would allow us to grow that to 19 counties. The last section before I turn it over to Pam is just in our long-term care for seniors and people with both physical and developmental disabilities. I think that the primary focus for the governor in this area was to first preserve the continuum of long-term care services. Again, there were a lot of difficult choices in this arena. This is the second largest area within the Department of Human Services budget in terms of spending. And I would be remiss if I didn't point out the linkage between long-term care and physical health care. When someone is eligible for Medicaid and long-term care services, they also then are eligible for the Oregon Health Plan. And so many of the individuals served in our long-term care, in fact, most that you'll see in our data, that our Medicaid patients also have acute care health care services through the Oregon Health Plan. And so although the budgets are compartmentalized in terms of presentation, they really are one and the same and very important. And when you see the budget drivers that Pam's going to walk through, when you think about the health care cost increases as well as the demographic changes that are heading our way, this is a very, very critical issue for Oregon. Oregon has a very long and very proud history in the area of long-term care service delivery. We were the first state in 1981 to apply for a home and community-based services waiver that allows us to offer our Medicaid clients choice of a service other than a nursing home or 24-hour residential care facility. The governor's budget really strove to preserve that continuum of long-term care services, and the kinds of services included in that are things like in-home support services, adult foster care, assisted living services, and then you move up into the more acute need services-based services, the 24-hour residential and long-term care. So there was an effort to preserve that continuum. There also was an effort to minimize the impact on people currently receiving services, folks that have been made eligible for Medicaid by way of their assets and eligibility criteria. We wanted to minimize the impact and provide as little disruption as possible in terms of the budget focus in this area to those individuals, particularly who are most acutely in need, those in 24-hour or nursing home facilities, but then also all the way down the continuum into in-home support services. Again, very difficult choices in this area, which I'm sure you'll hear much more detail about. But as you hear that detail, I hope you'll keep in mind these particular emphases, at least on our part. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Pam, unless folks have questions of me before I do that.
Questions for Lucille? Senator Bates?
Just a small point, and I probably shouldn't take the committee's time with this. On the student-based health centers, was there a discussion of trying to get those centers into areas of poverty versus where a lot of them are located now in areas which really aren't that poverty-stricken?
Well, I think that the department certainly can present you with the plan about where those are coming. The unique thing about these community services is that they're actually very community-driven. And in part, the department doesn't necessarily select where they'll be located, but the communities themselves have to raise the majority of the resources to support these facilities. The state actually provides, based on a formula, a very limited amount of dollars ranging from about, I believe it's about $50,000 per facility, and it goes up to maybe $150,000. And so we are really sort of seed money for communities that begin a discussion around school-based health centers and have started on their own to raise their own support and funding. And so the department probably has more detail about how those things get targeted.
Yeah. I should have taken your time.
That's correct. That's okay. Yeah, please go ahead.
Mr. Chair, she may want to point out, because you talked about the plus population, and not every member on here know that the standard population and what small percentage that we have currently now that is not general funded, but as a result of the provider tax. And so I didn't want the body leaving thinking that we had this population, this huge population that we really do not have, and that those two are together, because they're not. And Aaron did not mention that. And so, Aaron, you might want to talk about that just a little bit for individuals who don't know the distinction between the plus and the standard.
Coach Schroeder, Senator Winters, thank you. I focused on what we call the plus benefit group because that is the group supported by general fund dollars. There is another group, however, that has what's called the OHP standard benefit that's currently being supported through provider tax revenue. Those are taxes that the hospitals and the managed care organizations last session supported to tax themselves, and those dollars then are matched by federal funds, and those federal funds support a group currently of a little bit less than 40,000 individuals, but we will decline to a point where we support approximately 24,000 individuals through that benefit. I think one thing that's very confusing, I was very confused when I started to learn about the Oregon Health Plan myself, is that the difference between plus and standard and who's optional, who's mandatory, those categories get very confusing. I think of the plus and standard actually as benefit packages, not populations, because they each get a little bit of a different benefit. Within the benefit packages, there are optional. Within the plus benefit package, there are some population groups that are optional, according to the federal government, including some services for children and pregnant women above 133% of the federal poverty level. And some services for seniors and people with disabilities are also optional within the OHP Plus benefit. So I think that this program is very, very complex and sensitive to that. I appreciate Senator Winter's opportunity to clarify about the separate benefit package that is being supported outside the general fund.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Pam Teschner with Budget Management Division, and these next slides will bring you into more of a kind of a technical perspective, and as we go, if you have any questions, please let me know. This first slide just looks at the principle that Aaron has been talking about and how it compares, how it fits in with the other five principles. And so you can see that in general fund and lottery funds, this principle of health and basic needs makes up about 21% of the funding versus 31% on all funds. In this area of human services, there are some significant issues that's driving costs, and you've already begun to think about those and touch on those.
Senator Bates,
just for a clarification, a lot of us are new to this process, and they may be looking at these figures and going, why is one jumping 21 to 31% on all funds versus general funds? There's huge federal matches in most of the DHS programs, 40-60 match for everything we put up. They put up 60, and some of them are higher than that. And then there's the food stamp program, and it's also that's very expensive as far as total funds are concerned, but very low cost for the state. So just kind of keep in the back of your mind that we see these numbers jumping back and forth between general funds and all funds. The difference is the federal match for the most part.
Yes.
Representative Krupp.
Thank you. Just quickly, in talking about this issue of matching funds, in going back to your presentation, is it Amy?
Aaron,
my apologies. Back on page 5, you talk about preserving a continuum of long-term care services. But my understanding, the governor's cutting that budget, 80-some-odd million dollars, doesn't that have a relationship with federal money that then comes in as a result of that?
Co-Chair Schrader, Representative Cliff, I think almost all the majority of the reductions that take place within the Department of Human Services actually do have a relationship to federal dollars, including many of the reductions that happen to services for seniors and people with disabilities.
The big exception is the Commissioner on Children and Family, which is not part of DHS.
Although they do have federal matching dollars within the commission system as well.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bates, I do thank you for pointing that out, because in my running through this, I make some assumptions. And what we should say back on page 6 is, as you look at the two pie charts, the one on the left, which is called all funds, what it has that the one on the right does not is federal funds and other funds. And for the Department of Human Services, Senator Bates is exactly correct. There is a significant chunk of federal funds. And as we get through these slides, I'll point that out again, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. So thank you for pointing that out. Yesterday, as I was listening in, I heard a question about the demographics of the population and the aging population. And as I was sitting at my desk listening and watching, I thought, well, I'll slip in an additional slide for you that looks at the 85, I believe that was the question, the 85 plus population. What this points out, in the Department of Human Services, a large portion of their clients are in this age category of 75 plus. As we've just been talking about long-term care, most of the folks in that long-term care system are in this category 75 plus. And as you can see, there's some significant trends going on in this population. You can see the significant increase and then a slight flattening. Well, that's during those are the folks that coming out of the war era, the war births. And so you can see that the increase flattened out a bit, and then it really takes off with the baby boomers. And so this is a very significant issue for the Department of Human Services as you look forward into the future. Now, if I had more data, and those data are out there, but I stopped at 2017, but if you were to keep stretching this thing out, you would see it really, really climbing. So what I gave you, in addition to what's... Yes?
Representative. Great. Thank you. And I really appreciate you doing it, because that's a question I had asked. Because we had gotten the information the other day on the 85-plus population. What I put these two charts up. One is the 85 and one is the 75. Right. Why does the 85 not level off the way the 75 does?
Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Krupp, that's an excellent question. And I was sitting and pondering exactly the same thing as I was looking, because I also have a graph that shows the 65 plus, then the 75, and then the 85. And what it is that if you were to take this, the 75 plus, and you were to advance it 10 years, so take this whole chart and advance it 10 years, then the flattening drops off the chart on the 85 plus. So if you were to graph out for the 85 plus another 10 or 20 years, you would see it begin to flatten a little bit and then take up if the survival is that long. So it's just that that is delayed further into the future. So with the 65 plus, you see that actually right now, we're in the growth of that population is slowing just a bit and kind of flattening out. With the 75 plus, we're still growing, but soon it will flatten out and then take off. So it's just this 10-year delay of that phenomenon. So that the war births cause a slight slowing of the birth rate, and then the baby boomers will really take us into a high demand time for long-term care services.
Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Excuse me, Pam. Mm-hmm. Senator Bates.
Pam, I may be wrong in my evaluation of this, but the thing I also remember in looking at this, too, is the effect of medical technology on this age group. We're pushing our life expectancy up to about 90, and once we reach that level, we're kind of looking at something that's probably going to level off around 90, maybe 95. So you have two things pushing this bulge through the python. One is the baby boomers. The other one is how long those baby boomers live. And at a certain point, which you're starting to see here, that the life expectancy stops increasing exponentially as it has since World War II, and the population levels off, too. So both those factors involved, and I think it's why you're seeing more of a bump right at the beginning.
Right.
Life expectancy after World War II was about, I think, 70, if I remember right. Now it's about 85 to 90. So you have two factors involved, which also applies to your next one, which says why are medical costs going up? What's right there?
Yes. Yes, exactly. Thank you, Senator Bates. So the point of these slides, of these graphs, is just to give you that sensitivity to an area of this budget that is under great demand, and Senator Bates pointed out a very important issue, and that is that, you know, as technology increases and as the population life expectancy increases, all the healthcare costs are very significant at that end of the spectrum for age. The next slide looks at the long-term care system, those folks that are enrolled and receiving services in long-term care. And again, it kind of mirrors that same growth over time. Most of the enrollees, where these folks are, 80% of them are out in community-based care. And by the way, this graph right now represents a little over 30,000 of our seniors, about 34,000, I believe. About 28,000 of those are in community-based care, which is in-home services, adult foster care, residential care, and so forth. Then a small percentage of them are actually in nursing facilities. Now, you may ask what happened with that little dip at the end. If you remember, some of you that were here and intimately involved with the human services budget, we restricted services to the least impaired population. So we funded prior to that, we fund the most impaired, so that those who are least impaired, services were cut back to them. I don't know if you're familiar with, and I'm not overly myself since I'm really brand new to this area, the survival levels, 1 to 17. Last session, our funding dropped down to level 13 now. And so there, as a result, our population of enrollees dipped a bit. This one, Senator Winters was wanting you all to understand a bit about the Oregon Health Plan. And the important thing I want you to see here in this graph, not so much all the minutiae of detail about what happens in that as I call it, the mountain range, but rather just to see the significant shift in 1994 when this state expanded health care and created the Oregon Health Plan. And so you can see the impact. And before that time, it was primarily just Medicaid. But as we implemented the Oregon Health Plan, we pulled in and covered more populations. So, and Aaron mentioned in response to Senator Winter's question that in this graph, the majority of them actually are what we call now the plus population, a more traditional package, and a smaller percentage and a shrinking percentage is the standard population, which, as Aaron pointed out, by this next summer should reach a level of about 24,000. Right now, this represents about the governor's budget funds about 380,000 folks under the Oregon Health Plan.
We got a question, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Co-Chair Schrader. Last session I served on the Human Services Ways and Means Subcommittee, and Senator Winters really, really pounded into me a notion that I thought made sense, and that is we're part of a big system. And to visualize that, she brought in about 25 actors, brought them in. They each played a different role within the system. And the question I guess I have, or the thought I have, is does the Department of Administrative Services track how that big system would work so that that way as we're looking at things, we know where the bottlenecks lie? You know, the one thing that I think we're going to be charged with is trying to, or what we've been told we're charged with, is prioritizing and making decisions based upon the true needs of Oregonians. And I'm trying to visualize these 25 actors, the roles they play, from corrections to housing to human services to public health, and trying to figure out, based on those priorities, where are going to be the bottlenecks. And I'm curious if the Department of Administrative Services has any type of report where they look at how this all plays and interacts together.
Let me start now. Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Smith, as a matter of fact, yesterday I received an email. It was a very similar question to what you just asked. And I'm posing that question and trying to find that out myself. I don't know how global we track. And are you talking specifically about health care costs?
Well, I'm talking about if we decide that probation isn't as a priority as the judges, all of a sudden a bottleneck's going to hit somewhere. And I'm trying to figure out, you know, our co-chairs are charged with a massive assignment. Subcommittee chairs are as well. I'm trying to figure out, on a system as a whole, is anyone tracking where the bottlenecks currently and where they might reside based on the decisions here?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Gordley.
I think, Representative, that the opportunity to do that is taking place now. It started on yesterday with the overview of the public safety system, which is inclusive of our committees on judiciary, House and Senate, Human Services, Sub of Ways and Means, and the Public Safety Sub of Ways and Means. That overview is including skits. Yesterday we had a skit that was repeated from last session that took a client and moved them through every aspect of the justice system. Do you recall a similar skit from last session? Today we're going to be looking at another piece of the system, which is inclusive of human services and the Commission on Children and Families. I think in these presentations, which are, again, taking place over 3 days, we're getting at some of what you are asking us to consider, which is the connections, the links, and the broader picture.
You're saying exactly what I'm thinking. All right. And I guess in my mind I'm trying to expand that in thinking, you know, where does mental health play in with public safety? And then where, in, you know, housing, how does that play in, and trying to figure out how we're going to link all these together.
That's exactly what we're on taking a look at, and on the third day, if I just may continue the comment, on the third day we will be looking at budget implications in all of these arenas.
I'm probably premature on this. So.
No, this is the second time you've raised this type of question, and not it was last week when we were chatting. They're very appropriate questions. Unfortunately, I think the real answer to them is it's our job to answer that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's really what the process, we think this is going to be very difficult for the agencies to do. I think it's going to be a lot tougher for us to do when it all comes down to it. So that's a really excellent point, Representative, but that is actually, I'd like to think, as the state legislature in charge of the policies and our citizens, unfortunately, while they can identify a few of the key bottlenecks like they did with forensics last session, or the indigent defense budget last session, this is going to be our task, and it's not going to be an easy one, and it will be somewhat subjective. I think with all the players in the governor's office and DAS and the wisdom and the new energy we have here, we'll probably be pretty successful. Senator Morissette, Bates, and then
my comment to that is until we track what happens to people who fall out of the system, we won't know that. We don't know, and I don't know how we track that. We don't pay attention to the people who fall out of the system until they end up dead or in the emergency room or somewhere, but we don't pay attention to them. They're gone, out of sight, let's move on to something else. We're never going to find that answer until we take the time.
Mm-hmm. We'll go on to Senator Bates, and then Senator Devlin. It's been very nice to wait.
My comment will be very short, but it pertains exactly to what you're talking about. I've spent 15 years trying to figure out the answer to that question. Do you put your resources in education? Do you put your resources into health care? What part of healthcare to put those resources into? What's the best way of doing it to get the best results? This country and this nation and our state don't know the answer to that. And that's why we have this body as policymakers trying to figure that out. Because we really don't know. And we don't know what we do with as far as equality in our state. What do we do with people in poverty? What do we do with people in color? Where is that balance at that we get the most results for what we're trying to do, knowing that we can't make this a perfect world? So does DAS have an answer? I wish they did. I wish they'd give me a mathematical model that you put this here, this here, this here, this here, and we're all through. But it's very subjective. We don't know. And so we're going to do the best we can with the resources we have to get the best results we can. That's all we can really do. Thank you, and I'll stop here.
Senator Devlin, thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mine's actually just a request for information. I think when Aaron said that the Oregon Health Plan and eligibility requirements are very difficult for people to understand or to have clarity in, it's probably an understatement. Although I'm not a Human Services Subcommittee member, I do think it's important for members to understand what those eligibility requirements are. I have seen a one-page graph before, at least showing for the plus population what those eligibility requirements are. And I know it might be difficult to do that now for the standard population, but still, if you could provide something in that area. The other question I would have is for the enrollees, can you provide us some age demographics for who they are? And the final question, those are requests, this is simply a question. Sometimes when the Department of Human Services refers to a unit, and they say a client, they are referring to more than one person. Like the client for TANF, there might be two or three people in the family. When you say enrollee in the Oregon Health Plan, is that a single individual or is it a unit?
Patricia Schrader, Senator Devlin, it's a single individual.
Okay. Thank you.
That's the best question you've had yet today, sir.
Only question, but the others were statements.
Very good.
The next slide just looks at the rising costs of health care, specifically in the Oregon Health Plan, but this could be the same graph if you wanted to look at health care costs generally. We mirror what's going on in the rest of the states in terms of health care costs. It's just a picture that gives you a little bit of sensitivity that, as Aaron said earlier, our health care costs are inflating at 2 to 3 times the rate of general inflation and revenues. And so, again, that's major challenge that we have wrestled with, that you will be wrestling with, and how to contain that.
Question?
Question.
Can we go back to that last one, Pam?
Yes.
It looks like, as of January 2003, that the number is around $260, and in July of 2004, it's projected somewhere like $380, which is roughly a 40% increase in 18 months. What would cause such a quick rise in costs?
I think I'm going to have to, I'm sorry, Commissioner Schrader, Representative Richardson, ask the department to get back to you on detail. The numbers I'm most familiar with are biennial averages, and I'm not as familiar with these particular pitched snapshots in time, so I can certainly ask them to get back to you with that information.
Thank you.
I think that's a real good question, because since the standard population is not included in that figure, I assume, unless that is...
No. Commissioner Schrader, this is for the total Oregon Health Plan, so this includes all of both the standard benefit and the benefit provided to PLUS.
Can we ask John Britton to give us a quick answer to it? Because I think I know the answer, but I want to hear from John.
Real quick answer from our LFO analyst. That's
it. For the record, I'm John Britton, the Legislative Fiscal Office. My guess is that the drop there has to do with the mix of clients. And in that time period, my guess is, I know that we lost lots of standard people, so that the mix of clients leaned more toward elderly or to the PLUS population who have higher costs. So this is not just simply a result of higher unit costs, it's a result of a mix in caseload as well, a changing mix in caseload.
We'll explore that in the chair's committee. The adverse question.
Adverse selection. The fewer people you cover, the sicker they are.
Makes sense.
Like, I'm sorry. Mona Sanderson, Senators.
Another request that I would like to see is, of the OHP costs, what are the costs? Hospital costs? What are drug costs?
Co-Chair Schrader, Senator Mona Sanderson, we are currently wrestling with the cost drivers issue. That's a very good point, and one of the things that came out of the OHP work group that was organized during the interim was exactly that request, both from the provider community as well in terms of what are the real cost drivers in this program. And so we have a work group, actually, the Department of Human Services under Barney Speight's leadership has a work group that's organized to focus specifically on that area. And I think that group's work is targeted to conclude around March. And so there may be some delay. We'll get you what we have now, but I think there may be some time delay just in terms of getting information out of that work group that's coming together that's designed to include a broad array of stakeholders to review the data.
This is the trend in the food stamp caseload. In this case, it's food stamp households, not individuals, but households. So you can see towards the top of that graph, we're at roughly slightly under 220,000 households in Oregon that are receiving food stamps. I put this in here without a lot of detail, just again to illustrate how what happens in the economy, how that impacts the Department of Human Services. And it's that inverse relationship that some of you who have been around Human Services for a while understand completely. And for those of you that don't, when the economy turns down and we have a recession, which, as you can see on this graph, is in 2001, is when the recession hit. You can see what that did to the caseload. So as the economy goes down, it drives up the need for human services, and at the same time, it's limiting available resources to meet those needs. So it's a very difficult problem that we struggle with. And this just shows you, again, the impact of a recession and how the demand for services greatly increases in that kind of a situation.
These next slides puts these were very similar to the slides that you just saw from education that you will see tomorrow in the other program areas. Just to put everything in context, this shows you the funding by program area. So again, general fund and lottery funds is the pie chart on the right, and on the left, all funds includes federal funds and other funds. And for this program area, which is slightly different than the principal, as Aaron was pointing out earlier, the human services program area makes up 21% of the general fund budget, which is around $2.5 billion for human services. This, I think we saw this in the education side. I think she got that far. I can't remember when she said it was time to stop. So, but this is the one that shows you over time how the percentage of resources of state funds flow into these program areas. And human resources has, in as you go from 89, 91 up to 05, 07, you can see resources have been slightly squeezed down as public safety resources have increased. So that just kind of puts it in perspective for you.
Senator Morissette, question.
I want to go back to my last comment, and I should have put that in the form of a question. To what extent do you track people who leave the various services that we provide? And you don't have to get into that now, but I'd like to have some information about tracking.
There was some, if I may help answer that, there was some done, for instance, in the long-term care system when we cut off levels 14 through 17, and the initial indication was that about a third of them qualified for lower-level care, about a third of them went on to the Oregon Health Plan, and then a third of them decided that they would make do without and or had other situations happen to them.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, the other large area that we've had the ability to do some to glean some information around is within the individuals served through OHP standard and those who've been lost and some of the drivers there. But we can certainly sort of do an inventory because the department isn't the only keeper of that information. Often it's our partners who are helping us do that, some of that tracking.
Mr. Co-Chair?
Question.
Also in the area of TANF, there's they track to see how many people that come off of TANF come back onto the system within 18 months afterward. And in Oregon, I think it was like less than 3% end up coming back on within within 18 months, which was surprisingly low.
Continue.
All right. Again, let's see. I think I already talked about this, didn't I? This is human services split by fund type. So here's that picture we were talking about earlier, that if we look at all the funds that feed into the program area of human services, which you will see in a little bit is primarily Department of Human Services, 61% are federal funds. The vast majority of those federal funds are Medicaid, and also a big chunk food stamps, some TANF money in that federal fund piece. 13% other funds, a lot of that is provider tax and tobacco tax, and then general funds. So of the program area's budget, 61% is federal funds. That's the important thing there. And you can see how that compares statewide on the left. That human services has a significantly larger portion of federal funds. This is a story that you hear human services people telling, and Aaron alluded to earlier as well. When you look at their budget by category, not just by fund type, so this is general fund and lottery fund, the bar on the right is human services, and the message there is that 74% of their budget goes out the door in special payments. And special payments just means it goes into the hands of clients, or it goes into goes to providers who are providing community services, mental health, addiction services, health care. So it's hard when you look, when those of you who will sit on that subcommittee, when you look at this budget and what you can do with this budget, 74% of it, of the general fund,
in special payments that goes out to the community. And like Aaron said, if you were to have a second graph that showed this all funds, if you consider, if you throw federal funds in there with this, it is about 83% special payments. So the majority of their budget is in special payments, so it just flows right back out into the people in the community. I mentioned earlier, if you look at this program area, it is predominantly the Department of Human Services, and there's a graph that shows that. However, as you, in the months ahead, those of you in the Human Services Subcommittee, as you deliberate over that area, you will be hearing the Commission on Children and Families, Insurance Pool Governing Board, Blind Commission, Psychiatric Security Review Board, Long-Term Care. And you can see what piece of the whole Human Services Program area those make up, all funds and general funds. So it's just a picture, again, to show you that this is definitely the money is with the Department of Human Services in this program area. And the last slide takes just the Department of Human Services and gives you an idea of how their budget splits out by their clusters, as they call them, divisions, just a different name. For the most part, you can see almost half of the money in the Department of Human Services is going into health services. And most of that, of course, is the Oregon Health Plan. The money going into health services is about 50% Oregon Health Plan. About 30% of it goes into mental health and addiction. If we were to make this an all funds graph and we were to include federal funds and other funds, health services would make up more like 3/4 of the pie, because all of that Medicaid federal money going into health services. Seniors and people with disabilities is the second largest area, and 80% of that money is going into long-term care. So again, it just gives you a look at the Department of Human Services and where the money is portioned out in their budget. And that is all that we have on that.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your excellent presentation, good questions, good food for thought for the subcommittee members. With that, we will stand adjourned.